Good afternoon. So we're coming up on near the end of the semester. So we started the semester by looking at automating building programs and talking about how that process works. And we've kind of been switching between more hardware-centered topics and more slightly higher level software-centered topics. So we went a little into, you know, in a couple of different places, units on hardware tools that are provided to make OSs work. This included exceptions, and kernel mode, and virtual memory. We talked about some things OSs implemented on top of that, like accounts. We also talked a little about signals and context switching in context of that. We looked a bunch at networking, including both kind of how we built up networking and some security issues related to that, which were how we communicate securely on an otherwise untrusted network. Then we spent a bunch of time talking about, well, our hardware provides to ordinary programs the ability to do multiple things at once or with multiple cores. How do we take advantage of that? Talked about models for programming with threading and concurrency. And we also talked a bit about, in the middle of that, about caching. And we've gone on to talk about other things that are kind of like caching, that there are things the hardware does that are kind of invisible to us that make our program performance better. And that's going to be kind of our main topics for most of the rest of the semester. It's about these things that the hardware does underneath us. And the one we were just talking about last week was pipelining. So pipelining is this way of, rather than running one instruction at a time, we actually run multiple instructions together. And the pipelining strategy is that, well, we don't run, you know, the same part of each instruction at the same time. We run different parts at different times. So we're only doing one thing in our, say, instruction cache at a time, but we end up running the instructions faster. And one problem we discovered when doing this was something we called a data hazard, that when we did this in a straightforward way, we ended up running into an issue that, well, it turns out that our instructions depend on each other. So there was a reason why in kind of our naive processor design, we ran the first instruction, and then we ran the second instruction. Now, we didn't like mix that up, because it turns out it mattered that the first instruction like did something that we needed for the second instruction quite often. Not all the time, but often. And one of the things it did was producing a value that was written to some register, we want to be able to read this back. And with pipelining, it turned out if we didn't do anything, that wouldn't be possible. We have what was called a data hazard. And this hazard is sort of a consequence of two instructions depending on each other, and it working out with our pipeline that, well, they, you know, we were, you know, not right in the timing, that they were too close to each other, and so we need to do something about it. And we talked about kind of our primary technique for resolving these data hazards, which was forwarding. And this was based on the observation that, well, we don't actually need to wait for the value to go all the way to the register file. We just need to wait for the value to be available. And we can just send it from where it was computed to where it's needed as soon as the value is available. And often we found out that as soon as the value is available is right away, that we don't need to wait. Sometimes it turns out we do need to wait. Like we had the example of we were loading something that took some extra cycles to load it from memory, so we need to wait for that to happen before we could send the value to the thing that was using it. So we talked about all that thing with forwarding and thinking about when does forwarding happen. And then we finished up by talking about what will probably be our main big topic for today, which is about control hazards. So data hazards are we had the wrong value for some data. Control hazards are we have the wrong value or no value for our program counters. So like if we have a conditional jump, usually the way we figure out where that conditional jump goes is we look at the instruction we just ran before it. But it turns out, you know, that if we look at how the pipeline works, well, the instruction we just ran before, it hasn't actually computed anything yet by the time we want to figure out what to fetch next. And our solution for that, which we'll go into more detail today, is going to be that it turns out, well, we can fetch something and hope that we fetch the right thing. And if we fetch the wrong thing, we can fix that later. And how will we fix that later? Well, we'll just make sure anything we did based on fetching the wrong thing by going to the wrong place, by guessing wrong, we'll undo and then just move on. So questions about things we covered last time. So, talk a bit about anonymous feedback. So, one thing, am I going to post a study guide for the final? So, as you can see on the schedule, the last lecture is final review. When I'm writing the final, I'm going to look at what the schedule says we covered each week and try to have questions roughly equally for the weeks. Probably not actually going to end up equal because different things, you know, will feel like we're covered better in assignments and things like that, and you know, we only have so many questions and all that. I'm probably not going to have a practice exam because good final questions are precious, and I probably am not going to have a whole extra set of them. However, I do have some exams from the pilot versions of the course, which are now posted on the course website under the Study Materials tab on the top. Some notes on the exercises are really good. Yes, I really hope to have more of them, but sometimes they're hard to write. Asking what my hobbies are, nothing interesting. Also, some mentioning on logistics that we have some TAs who don't show up to their office hours. This is indeed a problem, and indeed something I talk to TAs about and or probably don't hire them again. So, please let me know when that happens. Sometimes there's a legitimate reason, like an emergency. Sometimes it's if you reschedule your office hours, you need to make announcements and all that. That they should know. If they don't, let me know. So questions on anonymous feedback stuff. Okay, so probably, so looking at this week's quiz, probably should talk about, I would guess, the first question. Start out. So the first question, we told you how long each stage was in a pipeline and asked, what's the time between when we start the first stage and when we start the last stage? And the most common mistake here is people say, if we only have 300 picoseconds of work in the fetch stage, that means it takes 300 picoseconds. And well, the work takes 300 picoseconds, but you can't move on until the next stage is ready. And you might say, okay, but the next stage only takes 400 picoseconds. Well, that stage can't move on until the next stage is ready. And if that stage takes 500, everyone's at 500. So it turns out that we need to set our cycle time to 500 picoseconds. We're not going to be able to speed that up. And so what we're measuring is 500 times 4 picoseconds. And this same principle applied in question 2. So question 2 said we had a 100 million instructions, and without any hazards or any reason to stall, the way this is going to work is we're going to start a new instruction every cycle. So some people missed that. Yes, we can start a new instruction every cycle. So that's going to end up meaning that we, you know, take 100 million times 600 picoseconds about. There's a little extra because of getting started, but that's kind of just extra at the beginning to get the pipeline full. But once that happens, we're finishing an instruction every cycle. Once the first instruction finishes its last stage, in the next cycle, the second one will, the third one, and so on, because they started one cycle apart too. Okay, and what else did I want to talk about on? Okay. And think, okay, we should talk about question 5. So in question 5, we gave you this processor which had this weird pipeline where we split up our fetch stage, we split up our execute stage, and our memory stage, and we were running this sequence of instructions here. So we think of what happens. We had this dependency. It ended up between the add and the subtract, that the add produced a value for the subtract. If there was no dependency, what would we do? We just start a new instruction every cycle and finish it one cycle apart. So if this subtract used something that was irrelevant to all the other instructions, we would just start it and finish it one cycle later, and that would mean that these two instructions would finish two cycles apart. But it turned out that we needed the value produced by the add, and since it's produced by doing arithmetic, that's the execute stage. So we needed to wait until the end of our last execute stage under the assumptions in the problem. You might say, wait a moment, couldn't the adder be faster than that? Probably, but that's not what the problem said, not what that processor design was. And we needed to have that ready in time for us to send it to the execute stage for the subtract. So it has that whole value ready by the time it starts. And so this meant that we needed to delay the subtract by one cycle, and we ended up with a 3-cycle gap. So questions on how I figured that out? Yes. Question, will it always be the case that I forward at the end of execute to the end of the code? No. So the reason that happened in this case is because if I think about what this subtract section does, this produces a value in execute. Produces a value from execute. And so that's why I had to forward from execute for that. And if I think about what this subtract instruction does, this computes a value, computes using its inputs in execute. So these instructions, they need their inputs for execute, and they produce their inputs after execute. But there are other instructions that don't work that way. So for example, if I had say a move RAX to R9, well, this produces the value from memory, so we'd have to forward from memory or sometime later, because that would be when the value would be first available. But in this case, when the value is first available is at the beginning of execute, when it's first needed was at the beginning of the execute of the subtract. But if our instructions do different things with the values, we might need them at different stages. Does that answer your question? Question, why not forward at the end of execute to the end of fetch? So what do you want that to look like? So do we need to adjust the pipeline diagram to have more stalling? Or?
Oh, it's just by reading the problem, it seemed like we should read the most up-to-date value in the register. Because when we decode, our values would be before the execute has finished.
When we decode, the values would be before the execute is finished. So is your question about, so what, you want to do a different forwarding for this? Is that you're saying to fetch?
Yes.
So to do that, is it the case that you want to have delay our fetch stage instead of delaying our decode stage? Is that what you want to do? So things would execute correctly if we did that, but that's not necessary because the first time we need the values is right after decode. So we can save a lot of time, and real processor implementations will do this, by not sending it earlier than it needs to, and thereby making all our instructions run slower. Even though, yeah, we could stall extra and we get the right answer as far as what values are in registers, but not as far as how fast we execute those. Does that answer your question? Yes, back there. Are there supposed to be two E2s? Is one in E3? They're supposed to be in E3, yes. This is just a copy paste. Other questions? Yeah.
Doesn't the XORQ rely on the RA register being updated after the fetch?
Question, doesn't the XOR queue rely on the R8 register being updated after the add queue? Because this is AT&T syntax, our instructions are all written operation source comma dest. So the add queue instruction does not change R8. Does that answer your question? Yes. The question, how does the decode happen in the same clock cycle?
After waiting.
So if we think of what the decode's doing here, the decode is going to read the wrong R9 and the right R10. And what we're going to do with forwarding is we're going to replace the wrong R9 with the correct R9, so it's not going to matter that we read the wrong one. Does that answer your question? And we're going to keep the R10 because it was right. Is that your question? Follow-ups? Yeah.
Are supporting happens right after the decoding before the execute, and you just like forward the value to the...
So question, when forwarding happens right after the decoding before the execute, we just forward the value right to the pipeline register? Yeah. So we're basically, if you remember what our design for forwarding in that example was, we had a mux. And before going into the pipeline register, we just had an option to select the forwarded value in place of what we got from, in the case of the decode stage, the register file.
So when we talk about forwarding to decode, we forward like after decode. It's not like going through the decode process.
That's a question. When we talk about forwarding to decode, we're forwarding to just after decode? Yes. That is what that's the design I've been showing. Yes, you could forward to the beginning of stages. That's just not what I've chosen to show as our design. And I note that if you said we were forwarding to the beginning of stages, we got the same answer because you'd say instead of forwarding from E3 to decode, you forward from the beginning of M1 to the beginning of E1. And you get the same number of cycles. You'd just be doing things on the other side of the pipeline registers. Yes?
Is the time it is avoiding the same time needed to, in between stages to the intermediate registers?
Question, is the time needed for forwarding the same time as needed for the intermediate registers? So we didn't talk explicitly about how much extra time the mux we add for forwarding might take. Usually it's considered to be pretty negligible, but whether that's true in practice or not, I don't actually know. Presumably it depends on whether the forwarding has like 4 cases or 20 or something like that. Yes? So the question, where do we deal with the flags register? So there are multiple ways we can do that in this kind of design. So one way that you could do it is you could have the flags register be read and written in the execute stage. And because it's always read and written in the same stage in that design, you wouldn't have to worry about forwarding because there'd be no disagreement in the order. If you had it written in the write-back stage, which is another option, then yes, you need to worry about forwarding of those values and try to kind of treat it like a quote-unquote normal register for that purpose.
But you would modify the flag register at the same time that you would do the operation?
This question, in the design where the flag register is read and written in the execute stage, you do it at the same time you do the operation? Yes. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so let's talk about handling control hazards. So in this case, I have a conditional jump. And one thing I could do when I have a conditional jump is I could say, OK, I'm just going to run this conditional jump, but I don't know what to fetch next. So I'm just going to wait until that's computed. And we're going to assume that the way our design works is that we compute that in the execute stage. And after we do that, we can actually do it. So we have our compare set the flags. And in the next cycle, the jump's in the execute stage. It can read those flags. And here I'm kind of assuming the flags are read and written in the execute stage. So this works out as far as hazards go without any forwarding. And then after we have that, we can use the result in the next cycle. So that's happened. And what's our cost for this? Well, this means that for the control hazard, we have to waste 2 cycles where we could otherwise, in a normal case, be running different instructions. And we have to waste it doing nothing because we don't know what to go, where to go next. So what we can do instead that's better is we can make a guess. So here, the guess I'm making is just that the jump doesn't go to the label. Just a guess. Could be wrong. And how do I use that guess? I'll just start fetching instructions after the jump. Just start running them. And when my guess is right, I just do nothing. My jump is literally a no-op. Now the problem is, of course, that this is not always going to be the case. Like, I don't actually know that the comparison is not equal. So sometimes I'm going to guess wrong, and I have to deal with that case. So what we're going to do in that case is when we actually figure out, does this jump actually need to go there, we're going to say, oops, well, shouldn't have started that XOR or move, and we're going to get rid of them. So I'm going to do what was known as squashing those instructions. So I'll replace them in my pipeline registers with no ops, with doing nothing. And then I will actually fetch the correct thing. So questions about this timeline here? Yeah? So the question, isn't this the same as our original scenario? So in the case where we guess wrong, yeah, the performance ends up being the same, that we end up running two knobs waiting for the result. The reason why it's beneficial is that sometimes we're going to be right. And in the cases where we're right, we just save two cycles, and the cost is that we're doing the same thing when we're wrong that we would have done otherwise. So it's kind of free. Yeah. So the question is, what if I have a jump at the end of the assembly file? What are we going to do? Well, it's going to read whatever instructions are after the jump and try to do them. And your question might be, what if that crashes through seg faults? Well, in that case, we better not act on that crash or seg fault until after we figure out whether the jump really is taken or not taken. Does that answer your question? Yeah. So the question is, when we have multiple threads, are we running different instructions in the sequence? So what I'm showing you here is just running one thread. So the sequence of instructions is intended to be for just one thread. So one function, one piece of assembly, running with one set of register values, and so on. And where we're doing this thing where we start instruction, we kind of split the executions, I think what you're thinking of. Like, this is just, we're making a guess for where does this current thread go and trying that until we're proven wrong. And in that case, we just reset back to where we were, but, you know, we're still running just one thread, one list of instructions. Does that answer your question? Okay, so your question is, if we have multiple threads in a single core processor, how does that work? So this technique is not going to help us with that. We're going to talk about something later when we talk about out of order, which is going to help us a lot more with that. And we'll get back to that issue then. Okay. Other questions? Yeah, back there. What happens to the labels above?
It's like in the code, what label, the label for, the code for labels above the jump.
What if the code for labels above the jump? Then we'd still go there. We still fetch these instructions from wherever that is. and way back, further back, we're intended to point. Yes. So the question is, does this mean that I should have it do the jump in the rare case? So I've told you, I made a choice to predict that the jump is not taken. Real processors will choose either, and well, we'll talk about strategies for doing that. But it turns out that the way most modern processors predict these jumps is right in for typical programs over 99% of the time, well over 99% of the time. So usually, it's not a big deal for performance. But yes, there are things you can do to help it. Other questions? Okay. So if we think of how this works, so let's say I have a program that has 3% taken jumps of its instructions. 3% are taken jumps, 5% are not taken jumps, and there's 92, did I do this wrong? Yes. There's 93, because we went out to 100% other instructions. My question is, how much faster is this processor given that we're doing this prediction? And note that it's a prediction that's right barely better than a coin flip. And for this program, barely better. So can someone tell me, how should I compute how much faster our prediction is? We are with prediction. Anyone tell me what's a good first step? As a hint, it's similar to a question we asked on the quiz about stalls. Yeah. Okay. So you're saying that you want to compute the average time for an instruction, and you say we can do that by taking this weighted average of the number of cycles for each kind of instruction. So if we think about what we're saying here is that in the case where we mispredict, we take 3 cycles, which in our pipeline diagram is we take 1 cycle as normal plus 2 extra cycles. In the case where, and in the other cases, we're taking 1 cycle. So that's our time for with our prediction. And we can compute what that is. And assuming I didn't totally screw up my math, this is something like 1 point, I should compute with the 1.06-ish. And we can do the same computation for the case where we don't have prediction, where we're just stalling instead. So in that case, well, we still take 3 cycles. We're doing different things in those extra 2 cycles than we did before. Previously, we were fetching things that we got rid of. Now we're not fetching anything, but it's still 2 extra cycles. And we also take 3 cycles in the case where we would have predicted, and one, and we'll get something that is 1.16. So it turns out that it's like 10-ish percent faster to do this prediction. Even though, if you look at this, you know, the prediction matters less than 10% of the time, but that's because, well, when you mispredict, we're spending 2 cycles. And on more modern processors, often the penalty for mispredicting is actually a lot higher than 2 instructions worth of stuff. It's often like 8 or 30 or something like that, in which case we'll have an even bigger gain for making good predictions. So questions, how I figured out estimated time here? Okay, so let's do, I made this fall off the thing. So let's do exercise here. Let's do the pipeline diagram for this case where we have a mispredicted branch in the middle. Use a little time to look at that. So I would start by saying, okay, you have fetch, decode, execute, memory write back, decode, execute, memory write back, and so on. We'd like some more time? Okay, so let's start with Where should I put the fetch stage of instruction number 3 here, the subtract? So who thinks I should put it in cycle 2? Cycle 3? Okay, a couple of people. Cycle 4? Okay, cycle 5? Somewhere later? No clue? Okay, so we have some mix of cycle 4 and no clue. So let's see if I go through what happens here. So if we think of what happens with this conditional jump, we're going to wait until the execute stage to predict if it's actually taken. So we're going to get our flags from our addition, get them through the flags register, and then figure out if it's taken. And here we're going to figure out, oh, wait a moment, these things I predicted are actually not happening. Okay, because we predicted it's taken, so we're going to fetch a couple instructions. And with our assumption that, you know, the execute stage is where we compute, is the jump actually taken, we do that operation, then those instructions are going to get squashed. So they normally go through all the pipeline stages. We're not going to let that happen because, well, we don't want to do whatever was at foo. That shouldn't have happened. We shouldn't have fetched it even, but we did. We need to fix it now. And after that, we can finally fetch, having computed the correct PC, the right thing. So I get cycle 4. So questions on how I figured that out? So then, and I have a truncated version. We had a push queue that I got chopped off here. R5. So then we have the subtract. And the subtract, it's going to go through its pipeline stages. And before we do execute, we need to say, does it have the value of R9 available? And RAX. So RAX, well, must have been computed before this because it hasn't been changed recently. So that's fine. And R9, well, that comes from this add queue. So we need to make sure it's available. But it turns out that we just wrote it. It's not a problem. So we don't need to do any forwarding to handle R9 there. Yes. So the question is, during cycle 4, the decode and execute parts of the processor aren't going to be doing anything for 2B and 2C? Yes, because we'll have suppressed those instructions from our pipeline as a result of figuring out what the jump is supposed to do. Yes, over there. Question, doesn't seem like there's a penalty for guessing wrong. So there's a penalty in the sense that if we guessed right, we wouldn't have these two wasted cycles. But there's no penalty in the sense that, well, we would have done about as bad if we just did stalling instead of guessing at all. Does that answer your question? Yes. Question, what's happening in 2C? That looks like a second guess. So if we, so let's say, at foo we had like an XOR and an instruction. In that case, this 2B would be the XOR, this 2C would be the AND. We're going to affect, when we guess, you know, we're not just going to guess one instruction, we're going to guess as many instructions until we figure out the guess is wrong. We're just going to keep going. Does that answer your question? Yeah. So the reason why we had a we have to waste two instructions because of when we knew our new evaluated our flags? Yes. Other questions? Yeah. The question, at the end of number two's execute stage, that's when we squash the other two? That's the assumption I'm assuming with this design. So hypothetically, we could maybe do it later and still get the right answer, or if we could attack that the jump is different earlier, we could do all this stuff earlier. But my assumption is that we're doing that in the execute stage because that's where we know we're going to have the right value for the flags and probably where we have the machinery to actually figure out where does this jump go. Other questions? Okay. So then we have our remaining instructions. So I have a call instruction, and we're just going to fetch this call instruction right after. And that call instruction is going to go to bar. And then we're going to fetch this right afterwards. And if we think of what other forwarding needs to happen here, well, this call this push instruction needs to read from R9 and RSP. So we think of, when does it need those values? Well, it needs the R9 value by the memory stage. It needs the RSP value by the execute stage. And normally, it's going to read them in the decode stage. And if we think of where R9 comes from, it comes from the subtract instruction. And RSP comes from the call instruction. So both of those haven't been written back to registers yet. So to execute this push instruction down here, we're going to forward just from our subtract instruction, R9, and we're going to forward from our call instruction, RSP. Questions? I figured that out. Yes?
There's nothing. If we're not doing anything with memory, all the values of like RIX and R9 will still be passed on to the memory stage.
So question, if we're not doing anything with memory, are the values of RIX and R9 still passed on through the memory stage? So RIX, there's no reason to actually have that after the execute stage. But R9, we have to get it to the write-back stage somehow. So, and the only way we're going to be able to do that is by sending it through the memory stage from execute. So it's going to have to be there. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
For the subtracting for forwarding R9, could we have also forwarded it after the stage for push, or did we have to forward?
So the question is, I drew the forwarding of R9 from subtract to push, coming from subtract's memory stage, going to push's decode stage. Could I have instead done from subtract execute stage to push's fetch stage? Yes, but it seems a little tricky to have circuitry that figures out that that forwarding needs to happen that early. It's more natural to delay, wait till decode, because, well, in the worst case, you know, you haven't even tried to read the value yet, so it might be written anyways. And also, you don't have the logic to figure out the register numbers yet, necessarily. You would have to move that earlier to do the forwarding earlier. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
So you always want to forward to the latest stage before it's needed. Is that what it is?
The question, you always want to forward to the latest stage before it's needed? You don't always want to do that, but generally you want to forward after you know what the register numbers are. So usually you end up forwarding to decode for that reason. The latest you could forward is just before it's needed. And you want to do that if that's going to save you cycles over the alternatives. In this case, it didn't really matter that much, but in other cases, it might save you a cycle to do that, in which case, yes, you should. Does that answer your question? Other questions? And just as an illustration, we could have this with a different pipeline, this same scenario, And our pipeline would affect whether how many cycles it takes for a misprediction. So if, for example, it took us more time to do, we had more execute stages, it'd be later until we got the correct values for the flags, and therefore could figure out where the jump goes, and therefore we'd spend more cycles fetching wrong instructions on a misprediction. And in addition, in general, longer pipelines mean we might have more cases where even when we do forwarding, we discover, oh, wait a moment, the value of, in this case, RSP, is not available yet. I'm going to need to delay the push to get it until later to actually get the right value. Okay, so questions on pipeline diagram? The question, are we assuming the jump here that we only need the flag conditions after E1? Yes. I'm making a bold assumption that the jump can evaluate the flags in one cycle, even though it takes us two cycles to do an add in this processor, which probably is something you would invest hardware in, because spending four cycles would be worse. Other questions? Okay, so I mentioned that, you know, when we did prediction of jump, sorry, yes, question?
Wait, maybe I'm just remembering an assembly wrong, but if you have call bar, and then you have bar directly after it, what, when it returns, isn't it just going to go through the instructions again?
So the question is, if I have call bar and bar directly after it, when it returns, wouldn't it go to the same instructions again? So I agree that if this were our assembly code and we returned, we would go back to that bar. My assumption is that bar is that I'm just listing the instructions in the order they run, not the order they appear in assembly. Okay, other questions? Okay, so when we talked about making these guesses, I sort of am showing, you know, assumptions where we make a particular guess, and processors want to make the right guess a lot of the time. So we learned that making any guess is certainly better than making no guess, but we can make good guesses. So I'll talk about a few strategies for making pretty good guesses, which are gonna get us to what processors do. And I'll start with kind of the simplest thing that gives us pretty good guesses, which is what we'll call static prediction. So this is static in the sense that I'm going to just talk about making guesses based on just looking at the assembly without knowing anything about what happens when it actually runs. And the static guess strategy that works pretty well and is very simple to implement is going to be what we'll call forward not taken and backward taken. This is also what we expect on the homework. So in this strategy, we say that if the branch goes to a greater address, we're going to guess that it doesn't happen, that it just is not taken, that we just go to the next instruction rather than jumping forwards. And if it goes backwards to a lesser address, we're going to guess it does get taken. And this works pretty well because if you think of how loops work, that there's basically two ways we can write a loop. We can write a loop so it has a conditional jump at the end that goes backwards. And if we do that, that's taken a lot. We should predict that backwards jumps are taken to handle that case. Or we can write a loop where it has a conditional jump at the beginning that skips over the loop by going forwards. And in this case, usually that's not going to happen, assuming the loop runs a bunch. So we should predict that as not taken. So this strategy handles sort of the common cases for loops, and therefore it actually does pretty well on most programs in practice. Like, yes, you could write programs where this is always wrong, we're almost always wrong, but that's not what typical programs look like, and this is the same kind of concept we have with caching, right? That most programs have a locality, and just like that, most programs, these predictions are mostly right. Certainly not always right. Yeah?
Is this a strategy for loops? How about, like, a simple if-else
statement? So this does not work very well for simple if-else statements, yes. And we'll talk about strategies which do. But we're generally not going to be able to make a great static prediction, meaning not using any information we learn from actually running any code for that. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so here, let's go through an example. So here I have a loop with two branches. So I start with EDI, I check if EDI is even, and if it's even, oh, I have the wrong labels here. And if it's even, I go to for loop bottom, go to for loop top. Oh, I did less than? Oh, yeah, I should make this loop actually run. This is what I get for rearranging this code. So let's do with my handwritten corrections. I am sorry for not realizing I changed some things in this slide without changing other things. So let's think of how many mispredictions we would have here. Corrected mispredictions. Forwards, oh my. So using the forwards not taken, which I just told you, and backwards taken strategy. EDI, and this is greater than 0. So let's start with how many mispredictions. So let's go through what this loop does just to clear. So we're going to do, initially, we're going to run this with EDI equals 3. And we're going to go through this loop, go to the top, and EDI is going to be 2 the next time. Then EDI is going to be 1. And then when EDI equals 0, we're going to end up returning. We're going to get out of the loop with EDI equals 0. Oh, and I have the wrong label here. How about that? Wow. I swear. I edited this loop. Edited this code. Why not? So let's start with who can tell me who thinks. So this JE here, it's going to run with EDI equals 3, 2, and 1. So who thinks we're going to have no mispredictions? Thinks we're going to have one misprediction. Okay. Two mispredictions? Three mispredictions? No clue? Okay, so we have a mix of one misprediction and no clue. So what's going to happen here is we're going to do if 3 equals 1, 0, go to... and 1 is 0, go to then 2 and 0. So what's going to end up happening is when EDI is 3, this is not going to be, we're going to actually, it's going to be not taken. But what is our prediction going to be? Well, since we're predicting forwards is not taken, and this goes down, it goes to this for loop bottom here, we're going to predict it as not taken. So that is going to be a correct prediction. Then when EDI equals 2, we're going to say 2 added with 1 does equal 0. So it's going to be taken. So it's actually going to be taken. Taken. But we're going to still predict it as not taken. So that's going to be a case where we're wrong. We're going to have a misprediction. Then when it's 1 again, it's actually going to be not taken because 1 added with 1 is not 0. And we're still going to predict it as not taken because remember, we're just making a prediction based on does it go forwards or backwards? It goes forwards. We're predicting it as not taken. So that's going to be correct. So we have one misprediction for the JE. So questions on how I figured that out? Yeah.
Wouldn't there be like another mispredictions when you get down to the fourth bottom?
So wouldn't there be mispredictions for the JG at the bottom? Yes. But I just asked about the JE for now. So then, after my, I'm sorry, that annoying corrections here, we have this EDI is greater than 0 checks. And these are going to run for, think of how this code works, we're going to run this for EDI equals 2, because we just decremented it the first time, then EDI equals 1, and then 0. And when EDI equals 2, it's going to be taken, we are going to go to the top of the loop. So the actual result is taken. And our prediction, well, it goes backwards, so we're predicting it as taken. So our prediction is taken. So this is correct. And when it's 1, it's greater than 0. So our actual result is taken. And our prediction is still taken. Doesn't change. And when it's 0, our actual result is not taken, but our prediction is taken, so that's going to be incorrect. So we'll have one misprediction for the jump greater at the bottom of the loop. Yes?
If you're asked, compute the mispredictions, would return also be something that
the question is, what's going to happen for predictions for return? We'll talk about that, how you might handle that later. But return seems a bit tricky, because what we want to predict isn't, does it jump somewhere or not? We want to predict what of the thousands of places we could return to doesn't return to. So we'll have to use some different strategy to possibly make predictions for that. Does that answer your question? Other questions? OK. So I've shown you this static strategy. So this is this kind of simplest way to predict. And I'll correct this slide to have a less bumbled version of this exercise. But as the word static hints, there's something, probably some dynamic strategies. And by dynamic, I mean based on actually running some code. And we can do something similar to caches, where we're going to say, we're going to look at what happened earlier to make our predictions. So we can take our program counter for the conditional jump instruction and have a table of past results for conditional jump instruction. So we'll just basically treat it like a hash table. I don't actually need to check if I get to the right entry because we're just making a guess. And if the guess is wrong, so what? So I just put my program counter through a hash function and look up in this table, what was the last outcome of this branch of a branch that has that hash, and make that prediction. So let's say an example hash function we'll use is that I'll just take some of the bits of the conditional jump address. In this case, I'll take bits 4 through 7, so the 2 in that hex there. So I'll look up an index 2 in this table. And the last result was taken, so that's going to be my prediction. There we go. And later on, we're going to find out, was this conditional jump I fetched now, actually taken? It's going to take a few stages. And when we figure that out, we'll update this table with what the actual outcome is. So it won't change if it's actually taken. We'll flip it if it was actually not taken. So next time, our prediction will hopefully be better, assuming the jump usually does the same thing. So as an example, let's say I have this loop here that runs 4 times. So I have a loop where we count down from 4 to 0 and go to the top when it's not. I should have a, wow, I've used this slide before. I should have a jump to the top when it doesn't happen. So we have the assembly version of this sort of do while loop. So let's say the first time we look it up, it's not taken. The actual outcome is taken, so we're going to update. You know, we get our prediction of not taken. We're going to update it based on what actually happens. So that means the next time we get to this instruction, we'll predict it as taken. And our actual outcome is still taken. And that will happen until our prediction is wrong because we got to the end of the loop, in which case we'll update the prediction to be not taken. And then we'll predict not taken the next time, which will be wrong. We'll update it back to taken. And we'll have that kind of cycle of predictions. But in this case, we're going to actually take advantage of observing, oh, this is a loop that, you know, keeps taking this jump. And this strategy will work really nicely for things like, as was asked about earlier, like if statements that will that if statements are usually we go to the then part or usually we don't, we'll remember this in this table, hopefully. Yes?
How did they decide, like, the designers of these types of predictions decide that, like, a specific, I guess, address bits is going to correspond to whether?
So the question is, how do they decide on the hash function for this? Generally, they probably experiment with a bunch of things in a simulator. Other questions? Yeah.
Why is this table useful?
What?
Why is the table for the original prediction useful?
Why is the table for?
Like the what to get to, what the prediction and the iteration is it going to be small somewhere?
This table here,
yeah.
this table I have of the actual outcomes. This is not stored. I'm just like writing down what happens as we go through this loop. The actual table that's in the processor, if you mean, is this table here. Yes, this will be stored somewhere, so the processor is going to have some memory kind of like a cache to store these prediction tables. So these are basically kind of like specialized caches, is how you can think of them. Okay, so other questions? So let's look at an example here. So let's say I have this loop here. What is my misprediction rate if I use that prediction strategy I just showed you? Or prediction or misprediction rate, your choice. Check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what happened. Whoops. Would you like some more time? And you can see what I'm doing is I'm just making a table of what happens for the first few I with what actually happens, and I want to figure out what the prediction's gonna be. To compare it to that. And I'm kind of assuming if the if statement is true, it's taken, but if it gets flipped, it doesn't actually matter because the table will just have inverted values and we'll get the same outcomes. Okay, so let's start with the predictions for this if statement. So who thinks that it's going to be predicted right more than half the time? Well, less than half the time. Okay. About half the time? Okay. No clue? Okay, so most people say less than half the time, and that's what I get. So let's go through how I get that. So there's a pattern here that when I equals 0, it's taken. When it's 1, 2, not taken. 3, taken again. 4, 5, not taken. 6, taken. So we have this repeating taken, not taken, not taken, taken, not taken, not taken pattern. And our prediction is always based on what happened last time. So I'll have to figure out later what happens for I equals 0. But when I equals 1, we're going to guess that it was just taken, so it's going to be taken again. That's wrong. And that's what the strategy I just showed you does. So that's going to be incorrect. Then we're going to realize, oh, it was just not taken. So we're going to guess that. We're going to get it right. So I equals 2 is going to be correct. But then we're going to say, well, with 2 it wasn't taken, so with 3 it won't be. That's wrong. So we're going to make a wrong prediction. And just got taken, so for 4 we're going to predict it's going to be taken again. Also wrong. But we'll be right for 5. So we end up being right about a third of the time. Okay, so questions? That. Okay, so how about our predictions for this if statement? So who thinks that we're going to be right more than half the time for this? Less than half the time? No clue? A few no clues, mostly more than half the time. So if I look at the pattern for this, when initially we have I equals 1, then 2, all the way up to 50, and it's not taken almost every time. And remember that because we have a table with this hash function, assuming these two if statements sort of hash to different places in that table, they'll have separate counters in the table. So we'll use the last result. So when I equals 2, we're going to say, oh, it's not taken, was not taken, so we'll predict it was not taken, and we'll get it right for I equals 2. For I equals 3, we'll say, well, it was not taken last time. Think of that, the same thing's going to happen this time. And we'll get it right. For 4, we'll get it right, and so on, so we'll get it right, except at the ends, where we might get it wrong. So we'll have it right probably like 90-something percent of the time. And when figuring out what happens at the beginning, by sort of wrapping around, I forget that overall, we have about 64% of the time we make the right prediction. with this one bit strategy. So questions on how I figured that out? Or the general process for thinking about these history-based predictions? Yes? Can I mention something about hashing to the different locations? So an assumption I made in assuming that I could look at each of these independently is that when we go into this table here, that I'm going to end up, when I go through the hash function, going to different places in the table for the two if statement, for the two if statements. Does that make sense? If that doesn't happen, then things are going to be uglier because the one of them will affect the other's prediction and vice versa. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so you've seen that this predictor actually maybe isn't so great, but we can extend this idea to make better predictions. So, and real processors often kind of extend this table of predictions idea with more information. So one example is that rather than just using what happened the last time, they can use information about what happened the last few times. So they can like say, rather than was it taken the last time, they can say, was it taken the last, most of the last four times, or something like that. They can also use the pattern. So if you see that it's alternating, like taken, not taken, taken, not taken, you can just record that information and use that to make your prediction. And this turns out to do pretty well in many real scenarios where programs do have those patterns. Another common strategy is rather than having a separate predictor kind of in your table for each conditional jump, which was kind of our idea, we can have a predictor that just looks at all the pattern of all the jumps. Because if you think of a loop, typically we'll have the same pattern of taking if statements in the loop or not and so on. And we can just expect to see a repeating pattern and look for that across all our jumps rather than having a separate predictor for each one. And this is another common strategy known as a global history-based predictor. So questions, these other prediction strategies, just mentioning briefly, yes?
So in real processors, are dynamic prediction more used than static prediction?
Question, are real processors, is dynamic prediction used more than static prediction? Yes. But the dynamic predictors start out empty, you need some default. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So one thing I promised I'd get to is how we deal with returns. How do we ever predict a return? So one way we can do that is we can have a little stack in registers of recent call instructions. And this is, in fact, something most processors do, is that they'll have a little stack of recent return addresses from call instructions, and they'll have the return instruction read that. You might say, what if they run out of room? Well, in that case, they just guess wrong. Or don't make a guess, install instead. But most of the time, they don't run out of room. You know, they might have like 16 of these, so as long as your recursion depth isn't deeper than that, it'll just predict right. And yes, and we'll talk next time about a little more about branch prediction, and then we'll talk about running instructions out of order, which is another big optimization modern processors do.